Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you're doing well. I'm Patrick Casey, sitting in for Henrik Palmgren, and you're listening to Red Ice Radio. Our guest for today is Chase Rachels. Chase is a libertarian, anarcho-capitalist philosopher, and Austrian school economist. He was formerly employed as an intelligence analyst with the United States Air Force. He is the founder and editor-in-chief of RadicalCapitalist.org, and the author of both A Spontaneous Order, The Capitalist Case for a Stateless Society, and White, Right, and Libertarian. In this show, we'll discuss the finer points of anarcho-capitalism and how they relate to nationalism. Chase, welcome to Red Ice. How are you doing tonight?
Doing great. Great to be here. Thanks, Patrick.
Yeah, glad to have you. So, Chase, we have a lot to cover here, including your book and how anarcho-capitalism can be reconciled with the alt-right. But before we delve too deeply into that, why don't we begin by having you introduce yourself to our listeners?
Sure. So some of you may have heard of me from my last two books I've written. The first one's called A Spontaneous Order, The Capitalist Case for a Stateless Society. The most recent one is called White, Right, and Libertarian. This book is where I go into marrying the alt-right with libertarian ideals. And I also am the owner and editor-in-chief of RadicalCapitalist.org, which also hosts many different articles on any subject, right-wing, libertarian, anti-left, what have you. I'm definitely excited about having this conversation today and seeing if we can make some inroads between the libertarian camp and the alt-right camp, because I think we have a lot to offer one another.
So as you said, the title of your book, or at least your most recent book, is White, Right, and Libertarian. What inspired you to write this book?
So one of the largest things that inspired me to write this book initially was the fact that I witnessed the libertarian movement becoming more and more immersed in sort of culturally Marxist leftist ideals, that they're starting to place ideas like multiculturalism, multiracialism, diversity, egalitarianism, even libertinism, like sort of hedonism and just self-pleasure on a pedestal. Like these are all, as if these are all complements to libertarian philosophy, as if these are things that are not only complements, but in a lot of cases, these same people, left libertarians, namely, will try to assert that they are actually part and parcel of the philosophy. And so that got me on the road to wanting to really determine what the essence of libertarianism is. And of course, the essence of libertarianism is private property. And the essence of private property is exclusion, not inclusion. And you can't exclude without discriminating. And the other thing that worried me was that, and I myself was actually guilty of this, I realized that many libertarians were woefully ignorant and unaware of the impact that one's sociocultural disposition has on his willingness to actually adopt the libertarian and free market capitalist ideals. Many libertarians have this naive notion that anyone in the world is just as amenable to them, like an Afghan or a Somalian is just as amenable to libertarian ideals or capitalist ideals as a Caucasian American. This is their sort of mindset, the naivety that goes along with it. And so when I discovered the alt-right, I was very fascinated by their cultural take on things, because I think from a cultural perspective, they have identified a lot of society's most disturbing ills. The fact that our time preferences are raising, the fact that we are starting to promote degeneracy in all its forms, whether it's promiscuity or whether it's just overindulgence in food or drugs or different alternative sexual lifestyles, and how they're trying to buck traditional gender norms as being oppressive and anachronistic. And this is essentially turning all the traditional Western institutions and values on their head. And it was only in the context of traditionally European values that libertarian ideals were born, that were able to be born and thrive in the West. This is why the West, whether in Europe or America or other Western influenced nations, are the most libertarian or the most respectful of private property. So when you get rid of the cultural values which undergird these nations, then the libertarian values, the private property is going to go along with it. Culture is always downstream from politics. So I guess that's a a long answer to a short question, but it was that realization that made me really want to delve into this topic a lot deeper.
You said something very interesting that I want to touch on for a second. There does seem to be this perception within certain parts of the libertarian movement, and even the conservative movement as well, that these classical liberal values, you know, free speech, freedom of assembly, capitalism and so forth, that these things are universal and that people from all over the world value them. And if they don't value them, it's just because they've been taught otherwise. But as you were saying, these things have been created by people of European heritage. So would you argue that, you know, without a white supermajority in Western civilization, that these values will be kind of kicked to the curb?
Oh, yes, I would absolutely suggest that. I would actually absolutely claim that, because you have to understand, it is only white Western Europeans who have a distaste for big government. This is something that's very unique to white Western Europeans. No other place in the world, no other people in the world want generally a very small, limited, or in my case, for instance, no government. They want a bigger government to take care of them, to impose all their values against other people, against their will. And they're usually not the values that we like. We're taught like the Islamic theocracies and so forth. So only in the West are we encouraging people to have dissenting views, to debate, to evaluate ideas on their own merit. This is the type of individualism that we promote in the West. And because we are willing to grapple with different ideas and concepts in an open environment to where debate is encouraged, we are able to suss out what are good ideas or not so good ideas. We're able to create a great environment for the flourishing of ingenuity and creativity. And this is part of the reason why the most advanced innovations and technologies have come from white Western Europeans over the last few centuries. We are definitely the ones who are the most oriented for private property, the most distrustful of government, who are the most promoting for sort of personal responsibility as opposed to a social justice or a collective responsibility for things. The nuclear family is also pretty unique to the West. So once you try to get rid of these traditional cultural Western institutions, the political and economic values are going to go along with them. And I would say it's not just a coincidence that the West actually invented these. This is a product of thousands of years of not just cultural norms that were developed due to the geography that we were evolved in, but also biology. In the Northern European climates, there are colder climates, so this encouraged lower time preference behavior. This means delaying and deferring gratification for future consumption. Because if you didn't do this, you starved the winter. It also promoted cooperation. You didn't cooperate with your fellow man and have a culture of reciprocity, then you're also going to be sort of outcasted from your community. And without the community's support, you're going to starve in the winter. We also have, as Western Europeans, moderate levels of testosterone and relatively high IQs. These are also very conducive to innovation, to lower time preferences, to the sort of Faustian spirit of the West. And all these things combined make the Western European people uniquely conditioned and uniquely configured to be amenable to these libertarian and capitalist ideals in a way that no other people as a whole are. Of course, you have your exceptions in any race of people, in any ethnicity of people, but by and large, for instance, in America, the majority of whites want smaller government, whereas the majority of all the other ethnicities want larger government. It's only the majority of whites that want to protect gun rights, whereas the vast majorities of all the other ethnicities want less gun rights.
Right.
94% of American libertarians are white, and this is not a coincidence. So we need to really take seriously the culture war, so to speak, if as libertarians we ever actually want to implement our ideas in a real society, in a real way, instead of just talking about them on the internet and virtue spiraling all over the place, purity spiraling, that is. That's definitely not getting us anywhere. And there's definitely a growing movement in the libertarian community that is becoming aware of this idea. And the libertarian movement is becoming increasingly polarized because of this. So on the left, they want to invite everyone in, be as inclusive as possible, even at the expense of the foundational principles of the philosophy itself. And on the right, we want to confirm and keep the philosophy thin and true, while at the same time promoting and encouraging other conducive traditional values to these ends. And these values are, of course, very European-oriented.
Yeah, I think freedom of association is one that really there's quite a bit of division within the libertarian community on, right? This freedom of association would mean that you can ban anyone, from your place of business and so forth, based on their religion, based on their ethnicity, race, sexual orientation, right? But that's not something that most libertarians, and obviously the far left libertarians really support. But, Hans Hermann Hoppe, and I'm sure Rothbard and the more authentic libertarians, I would argue, do support freedom of association, correct?
This is absolutely true. Absolutely true. In fact, the right to exclude is essential to libertarianism. And yes, the right to exclude could be on any grounds, whatever the property owner sees fit. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with discriminating against others on the basis of ethnicity or gender or sexual orientation. With ethnicity in particular, there tends to exist a higher social trust between members of the same ethnic group than between members of different ethnic groups. And when you have higher social trust, this lowers transaction costs for business dealings, and this also lowers crime and encourages cooperation. There are real reasons to promote this sort of ethnic homogeneity. And just because you can have an ethnically homogenous society like the Japanese do or like the Chinese do or even the Jews in Israel, just because you have an ethnically homogenous society doesn't mean you have to also sacrifice free trade with other nations. You can have both. And this is something that some on the alt-right and libertarians don't understand. They both think that in order to have homogenous ethnic communities, not all of them, but most of them, that you have to sacrifice free trade. The alt-right thinks that's a worthy sacrifice. The left libertarians don't. And my position is you can have both. And in fact, they work better together. And that's not just something that's better for white people to have ethnically homogenous communities. It's better for any ethnic people. And it's not something that would have to be forced. We don't need to promote forced segregation in order to make this happen. We simply need to end the forced integration,
right,
which is currently occurring through affirmative action, anti-discrimination laws, through the welfare system, where whites as a majority are paying taxes, a lot more taxes on net, whereas the other minorities like Hispanics and blacks are by a large margin net tax consumers. So we're essentially artificially subsidizing their birth rates at the expense of our own. And even socially, you watch a movie, you go to school, even the government, all you're hearing is you're promoting all other ethnicities to sort of encourage their own in-group preference, take pride in their heritage and their people. And this is a good thing. This is rightly so. But whenever it comes to any sort of person of European descent wanting to do the same, they're condemned as xenophobic, as Nazis, as just terrible, hateful people, that just because you have an in-group preference for the white people, that means you must hate all other people and all these other false dichotomies and things. So we're being targeted socially and legally in this country as a group, and it's a socially permissible group to target, white, heterosexual males. And it's something that needs to stop, because it's only because of societies that are dominated by white, heterosexual men with traditional European values that they're able to be so prosperous in the first place, which is what enables these other people with other alternative lifestyles to even survive in the first place. So it's kind of like the parasites, which are intentionally killing their host, but that's going to lead to their own detriment as well. And that's something that should concern all of us, even people who aren't of a alt-right bent.
Definitely. So I want to switch gears here a bit and talk more specifically about your book, White, Right, and Libertarian. So Hans Hermann Hoppe wrote the foreword for your book, which caused some degree of controversy, right? So what happened there?
Yeah, absolutely. So a few months before I published the book, I sent Hans the entire manuscript, cover to cover, and I said, Hans, I love your work. Would you be gracious enough to do me the honor of writing the foreword? And to my mind, it was a long shot, but thankfully, he agreed. And this was great. And he knew the title, he knew the whole book, he knew what it entailed, and there is really nothing in the book that's any more incendiary or controversial than anything he himself has written about or spoken about, right? When this became public that he's writing the foreword, I kind of announced it in one of my private groups. And in this private group, the president of the Mises Institute, Jeff Deist, as well as one of his colleagues, Tho Bishop, they were very alarmed by this, alarmed specifically because of the title itself and because of the sort of optics, if you will, of the whole thing. And in addition to this, one of my other friends who happens to work there, I had earlier shown him a concept for the cover, which I hadn't made public yet because I was still working on it, and I hadn't shown Hans yet because it wasn't complete, and I wasn't going to publicize it until I had his approval, but I kind of showed him to get his thoughts. Well, apparently he assumed that I would publish the book with this cover without showing Hans and getting his approval, so he says. So he showed this to Jeff, and admittedly, it was sort of a incendiary cover, but intentionally so. That's kind of what garners attention these days, and you can't really make any impact if you don't have anyone's attention, right? So anyways, Hans emailed me back after Lou Rockwell, the founder of the Mises Institute, and Jeff Deist had called him and pressured him to withdraw his blessing for the foreword. But, of course, he just only mentioned it was because of the cover. I told him I'd be happy to change it, which, of course, I eventually did change the cover to be something very innocuous. Yet he still wanted to withdraw it. It was very clear this is because of the interference of the Mises Institute staff. I tried to work with them directly because I had great respect for them. I said, hey, you know, let's come to some resolution together. Let's work this out. I wish you all had come to me first without going to Hans, but... But bygones be bygones. Of course, they didn't want to work with me at all. They had no intention of finding a mutually agreeable resolution. So I end up publishing the foreword as is, even without Hoppe's blessing, because he had agreed already with the full book and full knowledge to do it. And I even changed the only thing that he had expressed concern over, which was the cover. And of course, after this happened, it's my belief that one of the Mises Institute people actually leaked the cover, which is kind of ironic because they were afraid of it getting out, in order to make me look less credible, I suppose. And they also were publicizing details of things which were supposed to be kept private. I didn't want to publicize our controversy because I didn't want to create a bunch of drama and make them look bad. I still thought they were a good institution. But after a lot of the slander came out on libel from their workers, I had no choice but to reveal the whole story so that I could save my reputation from the sort of libel that was being promoted. And it just kind of escalated quickly and became kind of nasty. And long story short, we kind of broke our ties off, and it seems that the Mises Institute is much more concerned with staying politically correct, not touching the white European aspect of libertarianism, and maintaining their donorship than they are about pursuing the truth and breaking all the taboo barriers that are keeping us from not just discovering the truth, but even talking about it in a public sphere.
So in the first chapter of your book, you outline what anarcho-capitalism is. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Right. So when I originally in the first chapter, I just wanted to define what libertarianism is, because it's an ideology that's been very bastardized and perverted by many on the left. And it's not even understood by libertarians who aren't deliberately trying to obscure it, who just kind of have a bumper sticker understanding of what it is. So this is a chapter where I make the case that libertarian is only and strictly, ultimately, about private property. It's about you have private property in your body, and whatever you acquire through homesteading and voluntary exchange, and that's that. It has nothing to do with social justice or equality any more than anything beyond just strict equality before the law. It has nothing to do with libertinism or multiculturalism or any of this stuff or LGBT issues, nothing. It's just about private property. And I kind of demonstrate why that is in the chapter. So it's sort of a good foundation for the book to kind of get everyone on the same page as to what we're talking about here. So once I define what libertarianism is, in the next chapters I can sort of elaborate on how and why it is complementary with many of the alt-right ideals and concepts.
Now, many libertarians these days are under the impression that border security and immigration restrictions are somehow totally at odds with libertarianism. Is this authentic libertarianism, or is this something else?
No, not at all. And this is one of the hot topics in the libertarian community. And even right libertarians who aren't friendly with the alt-right, even they are aware of this fact. To put it simply, and of course, the chapter I write, Libertarian Case Against Open Borders, goes into far greater depth and in detail as to why this is a very fallacious position that libertarians take. That's not consistent with libertarianism itself. Of course, many people make the utilitarian argument, the practical argument, well, we can't have a libertarian society if a bunch of socialists and welfare parasites keep coming over the border and voting for bigger government. That's the practical side, and that's true. But the unique thing about my chapter is I look at it strictly from a libertarian perspective and deconstruct the notion as to about open borders being libertarian when they're the furthest thing from. Basically, open state borders and giving indiscriminate access to anyone in the world to public property is tantamount to communism. You're giving anyone in the world equal and indiscriminate access to scarce resources. That is communism. That's like the definition of communism.
Right.
While at the same time, you're precluding any people from privatizing these areas. So you're using coercion to preclude the privatization of these scarce resources, yet you're opening their access up to anyone in the world. This is communism. This is the opposite end from libertarianism. So what I argue in the chapter is that it is, in fact, the net taxpayers who have the superior claim to what's, in my mind, a misnomer, which is public property, that they are, in fact, the joint private property owners of what's considered public property under the current paradigm. And that because of this, they, as joint private owners, have the right to institute restrictions, to implement restrictions to access to this property. That they have a higher claim, and they can restrict access to it against those who have no claim, which are foreigners who have paid no taxes or have not been victimized by the state in question whatsoever. They have a restitutive claim to it. And I go into this chapter to depth as to why this is. I cover a lot of the strongest and the most common objections that libertarians have to this idea. When it really comes down to it, the notion that open borders is the most libertarian solution really is born out of an ignorance from many libertarians. Again, they only have a very shallow bumper sticker understanding of the philosophy. For instance, they'll think that libertarianism means we're pacifists. We're just against all force. And what they don't recognize is that, well, trespass is a private property violation. And when you trespass somewhere, the owner or owners can rightfully evict you. And the force they use to evict you isn't an initiation of force. You know, the force is initiated when they trespass against your property. And just little nuances like that, which seem obvious to people like you and I, but it goes over their heads because it doesn't fit into the sort of narrative that has been crafted for the libertarian community as a whole. They want to promote themselves as being socially liberal and economically conservative. That's not really a true description or reflection of what libertarianism is. We're not socially liberal. we just respect and understand the value of private property rights and free markets, and that's it. That doesn't preclude us from also valuing traditional gender norms and European Western values and nuclear families and prudence and all of these things.
So quite often on the right, I see people ascribing quite a bit of blame for our current immigration crisis to capitalism. And their argument basically boils down to the fact that, you know, there are powerful financial interests and so forth benefiting from cheap labor. Is that a position that you hold, or do you think that it's actually the government to blame for open borders and for, you know, illegal immigration and even large amounts of legal immigration into America?
Well, it's absolutely, I place blame on the state, of course. And what we have now is not a purely free market capitalist society. Of course, our economy leans closer to the capitalist end of the economic spectrum than the socialist end, which is communism. We may lean closer to the capitalist end of the spectrum, but that by no means entails that we have a genuine free market capitalist economy. We have the largest state in the world. We're $20 trillion in debt. Any dollar the government takes and spends is a departure from capitalism, from private property. So that in itself should demonstrate that this is not a sort of environment that's reflective of a free market capitalism. What it is, however, is a sort of, what you do see is a marriage between the corporations and the state. And this is where you get the worst of both worlds, so to speak. Every regulation, every law that is written, they promote these laws and regulations so that they're implemented to protect workers or the consumers, when in fact they're lobbied for by the bigger corporations because they know that it's much easier for them to cover the cost of abiding by these regulations than it is for small mom and pop shops who sort of cave in under the onerous weight of all these regulations and taxes and intellectual property laws and licensing fees and requirements. In addition to this, the more we tax and regulate our own businesses, the more attractive it becomes to outsource to other countries because it's just an increasingly less friendly environment for business to thrive in. And the reason why it's not necessarily true in a free market capitalist society that people just want to bring in quote unquote cheap labor is because the people and the infrastructure in more developed countries like our own are such that each laborer, because of the capital they have access to, because of their greater skills, can produce more value. And this is what justifies paying them a higher wage. Whereas foreign labor that's cheap is largely unskilled, right? So they're not going to be as valuable as someone who's semi or skilled laborer here. And also, there wouldn't be the need to import them over here as much if we didn't have to, again, abide by all these taxes and regulations and licensures and whatnot. And even if it was the case, that it might make more financial sense, a purely financial sense, to bring in foreign workers. That doesn't mean that that would necessarily happen, especially not in an ethnically and culturally homogenous society, which is the type of society that I promote that places a high premium on traditional European values, because there is more than just monetary profit. There's also psychic profit. And many people will opt to have a marginally lower material standard of living in exchange for keeping their communities wholesome and consistent and keeping their integrity and consistency with the sort of values and norms that they and customs that they cherish, in this case white European values. So there's a misunderstanding on the right and alt-right especially that capitalism and libertarianism is all about just ignoring social factors and cultural factors and only just doing what makes you the most money, but this isn't true. It's only about respecting private property, and many people get more profit, maybe it's psychic profit, from having ethnically and culturally homogenous communities than they might from having a marginally higher material standard of living. They need to understand that. And when you don't have all the taxes and onerous regulations and free trade deals that aren't actually free trade deals, then you're going to see small business being able to thrive. You're not going to have your standards of living being continually deteriorating while more and more droves of foreigners come into your community, into your country. This does not happen to the degree that it does now, anywhere close to it, without the state actually meddling in people's affairs and coercively redistributing income and subsidizing their immigration and enforcing them into our communities by making us associate with them through anti-discrimination laws and the like. Right. It's a very different environment.
Yeah, there absolutely is an incentive for powerful financial interests to have a very cheap, underpaid working class in the form of illegal immigrants as their laborers, right? But I think these things are issues with immigration are ultimately the result of policy. Policy and incentives, and the government is to blame for quite a bit of that. And perhaps you could argue that, you know, these powerful financial interests are lobbying the government and buying off politicians to get these policies, right, and to have these incentives exist as they are, and I think there's a strong case to be made for that. But yeah, it's just blaming it on capitalism in this particular instance really doesn't really cover how extensive and doesn't cover all of the nuances to the issue of immigration that we face. So I want to ask you, as a libertarian, how would you go about solving America's immigration problem, both legal and illegal?
Right. Well, first, before I get to that, let me also mention that it's in these politicians' best interest to continue to invite in all these foreign immigrants, because foreigners, especially Hispanics and Blacks, they always vote for a larger government. They are very dependent upon welfare. And you can't have a larger welfare state without having a larger state. So they know that the more votes they get from big government, the more power they have. So it's in their every politician's interest to keep bringing these people over the border. But as far as how I would help solve the immigration issue, from a policy standpoint, I think one of the first immediate things you can start doing is not allowing immigrants who want to come over here the right to vote. They shouldn't have a right to vote. They don't have any claim to these resources like the net taxpayers here do. They're coming over here. They're guests. They shouldn't be able to vote. They shouldn't be able to have welfare. And we should also, and this might seem kind of strange to some alt-righters, we should also end things like tariffs, things which penalize people for wanting to trade with us. When you get rid of the tariffs and the trade barriers between nations, there's less reason to move into our country. Because if they get into the U.S., they can overcome and get around the tariffs and trade barriers that would otherwise exist. But if there's no trade barriers to begin with, there's less incentive to be here. If there's no welfare, there's less attraction to being here. If they can't vote, they're going to have less of an impact on the changing nature of our government and our policies. And I think those are probably big first steps. Of course, in this current environment, that's probably not going to happen. I think we should, at the very least, not let anyone with a criminal history into this country. And I think that's something that could be realistically imposed. No criminal history people coming in here. And I would also say not to let any socialist or communist in the country. These are people who are inherently opposed to the very idea of private property, which means they're also opposed to a very fundamental American tradition. And that the people who come here, who do come here, they at least need to be very willing to assimilate into our Western European culture, very eager to, as opposed to bringing their culture with them. This is not supposed to be a melting pot. For the very few exceptional immigrants who want to come over here and assimilate and have something to offer, and they want to purchase property, and they want to contribute to the community as a whole, you know, so be it. But we need to realize that this is going to be a very small minority of people when we're talking about coming from Latin America or Africa or the Middle East. This is a very tiny, minuscule minority. And it's so small that, honestly, there would be nothing wrong with having a very pro-European immigration policy and being very strict about what other people can come into here when they're coming from Latin America, Africa, or the Middle East. That would be sort of my, off the top of my head, ideas. I kind of go over some of these ideas in the chapter as well about what we can do policy-wise now to help mend the issues that immigration has already caused.
And I'm guessing you would support things like mass-scale deportations of illegals, an E-Verify system, and so forth.
Yeah, that's where it gets a little more complicated, but I think it'd be a lot easier to just simply institute no welfare, no voting policy for these people than it would be to deport them, which is going to cost a lot of resources, create a lot of conflict, a lot of strife. If they're not able to live off the dole anymore, they're not able to have a say in policy. A lot of them are going to leave on their own accord anyways, go back to their homes. And that would be something that would be great, right? If we're also allowed to discriminate, we're allowed to lift anti-discrimination laws so we can choose not to let, we can rightfully choose not to rent our homes to them. We can rightfully choose not to bring them in our schools if we don't want to. We can rightfully choose not to cater to them in our businesses. And when they find out that people just don't want to associate with them, that they're not welcome in a social sort of sense, they're going to leave of their own accord. I'm not someone who's going to go out there and object to mass deportations, but I don't know if it's something currently that I'm going to endorse either. I certainly won't complain if it happens.
Fair enough. So would you support penalizing corporations and businesses that hire illegal immigrants?
No, definitely not.
Why not?
As far as I'm concerned, businesses should be able to hire and fire whoever they want for whatever reason they want to. I think what we need to target is the state. Businesses are just going to do what they feel is best for their business, as they should. You know, that's what they should do. The issue comes into play when they are able to have power over governmental state policy. And when they have power over state policy, they're able to get legislation passed, which raises barriers to entry into their industries, which harm the most the small mom-and-pop shops, small businesses. This is the crux of the issue. Not so much who they want to hire themselves, but the artificial barriers they raise to entry for other small businesses through regulation, through taxes, through licensures, and the like. I think that's really the crux of the issue. And again, like I said, you get rid of the welfare, you get rid of the anti-discrimination laws, you get rid of the right to vote, you're going to see people leaving of their own accord and people shutting these people out from their businesses and communities naturally. I don't really think you would really require a massive state apparatus to come in and deport these people. But again, like I said, it's not something that I would object to either. So.
Well, yeah, I mean, you're definitely right about removing the incentive. That should certainly be done first. Mass deportations would be terribly messy, and I'm certainly not opposed to that should that be required, should that be necessary. But yeah, removing incentives first, I think, would definitely be a good first step, and hopefully that would be sufficient to at least solve the issue of illegal immigration. The issue of legal immigration is another one altogether, but that, again, is something that's would have to be determined at the policy level, at a national level.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Chase, this is going pretty well, but we should go ahead and wrap up for our break here. Before we do that, why don't you go ahead and tell everyone where they can find you on the Internet?
Okay, so you can find my website at radicalcapitalist.org. We are always publishing a lot of great grade A articles on anything libertarian, alt-right, anti-left, anything you can think of there. You can find my books, White Right and Libertarian and A Spontaneous Order, on Amazon. For my book, A Spontaneous Order, you can get it in Kindle, paperback, and audio formats. And for my newest book, you can get that currently on paperback and Kindle formats and soon to be audio format by the middle of this month on Amazon. So check those out.
All right, well, hang tight, folks. We're going to take a break, and then we'll be right back.